Today, after some conversations with friends and students and some colleagues about their own plans, maybe it's time we talk about why being part of a denomination is a good thing, a bad thing, an essential thing, a superfluous thing. At least about why being part of a denomination is such an important thing.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So as I mentioned, this comes out of a lot of conversations I've had recently, and not just about Baptists. I am a Southern Baptist. I've been Independent Baptist and Southern Baptist my entire life. That's where I've done ministry. That's where I normally preach. When I preach in a Bible church, community church, on a rare occasion, a church with a different denominational name altogether, can't even remember one right now, but I have. Then it's, you know, that's the exception. So my life's been Baptist, but this conversation is not about the Southern Baptist denomination or about Independent Baptists or about community churches or about Presbyterians or Methodists. It is about Christians who are, in one way or another, associated with denominations. And sometimes, normally, it's because they're part of one. Other times, it's because they refuse to be part of one. But one way or another, we're still tied to the idea of these denominations. And this is not a discussion, as we've had in the past on previous episodes, about why denominations are not such a huge problem for Christianity in the world. It's not that. I think there is value to the divergence of views that we have from different denominations. And I think it's important to keep that in mind, that we don't have to be disdainful of other groups in order to be part of the group that we have grown up in and to which we stay attached now. We don't have to do any of that in order to value the thing that we do have. It's not about that, although I just talked about it. It is about, you know, so in the same way that a lot of Christians, a lot of people who've grown up as Christians are deconstructing, and again, we've had that conversation, different episodes, as much of a conversation as there is about that, there is always that conversation also among believers and among Christian leaders about whether to deconstruct from their denomination. They wouldn't use that language, but that's the idea. Do I give up the structures within which I've developed my ministry, within which I've grown up to be this leader that I am? And that's what I want us to talk about. And not just among leaders, but also among church members and just Christians in general who say, well, I don't want anything to do with those Baptists, or I don't want anything to do with those Methodists anymore, even though that's the group I grew up in. So I just want us to think through it. And I don't have an absolute answer. I do have some, I think, essential ideas to keep in mind if that's where you find yourself right now, whether as a church leader or a person who's just trying to find your way with your own Christianity. So starting out, there is a default position that we all sort of take. And I'm not saying everybody stays in this for very long, but it is the position of staying. And what I mean by that is we have a heritage that we carry into our lives. And our natural tendency would be to continue that, to replicate sort of in some form, obviously personalized to our own experience, the things that our parents handed down to us in their tradition. And so, and that was the case with me. I mean, I grew up going to church. I grew up in Southern Baptist churches. My exception from that was were the few years that I spent in independent Baptist churches before I returned to Southern Baptist churches. So I know the sense of this is what my parents handed me, and this is where I'm going with my life. And I'm 61 years old now, and I'm still a part of that denomination. That's who I am. I will say that as the default is not surprising, and it's not a bad thing. Those traditions exist for a reason, and we value our parents for a reason, and what our parents give to us matters for a reason, and all of those things are fine. This is the traditional notion of conservatism. You just sort of stay where you were to begin with. And if you don't run into any anomalies or any critical circumstances or anything that breaks the system, then it makes sense that you would stay in that world. I'm grateful to my parents that I had enough of a positive experience with them throughout my life that I didn't see any need to try to venture off elsewhere, I mean of any significance, to find my identity within the Christian world. So I'm grateful for that. That's normal. And it's also built into even taking it. I know that not everybody grows up in a Christian home, and not everyone's raised by their parents in a church. And so it's also the case that your personal history will influence you to want to be in the organization, the group, the whatever that you started with. And so your personal history contributes to the idea of continuity in your identity, your Christian identity. If your conversion took place in a Lutheran congregation, if that's where you first encountered what it was to be a part of a community of Christians, then of course it's natural and, again, healthy and good that you would want to continue to be a part of that. We would hope that every Christian expression would be a healthy Christian expression where the fruit of this Spirit is encountered and where the transformation that comes with just knowing the resurrected Lord would be realized, and therefore you would have a tendency to stay in that setting. And whether one denomination holds a doctrinal view that you think is worse or better than another denomination, and we do hold specific doctrinal views, that's fine. But whether you hold that or not, we would still hope, wouldn't we, that every Christian expression would be a healthy expression of the Lordship of Christ. And, you know, if that's the case, then it would make sense that we have a history that says, that's where I was baptized. You know, I remember the moment I had my first girlfriend and it was in that church. You know, this is the reality of our lives. That's where I was married. That's where my grandfather was buried. That's where I went to the funeral service. That's where I met a pastor who was able to explain to me this or that, that solved this crisis in my life about what my vocation was going to be. All of those liminal moments that we encounter and cross over in a particular environment would incline us to love that environment, to want to be a part of that environment going forward. It would bring a nostalgia and a comfort with it that's important. You can say, oh, that's psychological. You're not telling me why I should be a part of this or that denomination. That's the point. I'm not trying to pick which denomination, not trying to say it's about one denomination. I'm trying to say there are elements that are automatically going to incline us, good, bad, or indifferent, to stay where we are, to be in the denomination where we, for instance, grew up or where our faith took root. Same thing with, by the way, the training, the formal training, and sometimes less formal training, that we do inside of denominations. In the informal sense, we do it with the conveyance of an ethos, of a set of values and cultural norms and expectations and behaviors that we may or may not even realize become an important part of how we identify ourselves within those groups. When I've been in other groups in the settings where other denominations were celebrating their pastor, for instance, or the history of a church and its background or whatever, I've realized that the jokes are all very similar to the jokes that people tell on their own denomination. So, for instance, I've been in a setting where I've been in 100 settings where I've heard, well, you can't have a Baptist fellowship without food, of course. But I've heard the exact same language when I was sitting in a setting where I heard Catholics talking about their fellowships. Well, you can't have a Catholic setting without food. Well, you can't have Methodists get together without a meal, and so on. You know, everybody does that. And the reason they do it, I'm just picking the example about food because that one seems to be universal. I don't know for sure it is. I haven't been in every denominational setting, but where I've been, that seems to be a point of odd pride, by the way. Well, we can make a person fat is sort of what they're saying sometimes. It's really, and which seems to be true, by the way, in most of the settings I've been in, and about me. So I can say it's true about me. Anyway, the point is that kind of jocularity. So we're poking fun at ourselves, but at the same time, kind of proud of the fact that we're this way is a way of subtly conveying the ethos of your denominational identity. Aren't we special? Our grandmothers cook better pies than everyone else. You don't want to go over there with those, you know, whatever that other denomination is, because you wouldn't be able to get this pecan pie there, and so on. And it's, by the way, very similar to the ideas that go along with, and I know this one because I'm from Texas, state pride, and the jokes we tell about that. It starts out with jokes, by the way. Starts out just, it's just like, we're just having fun. But it does end often. I would say always. I think it is always, because anytime you make people the butt of your joke, there's a harm that comes from it. And so it may start with light jokes. And again, I'm not condemning the practice. The practice is so universal, I would have to condemn everyone. I'm not condemning it. I'm just saying, let's be aware of this. That this conveyance of the ethos through jokes and things like that also does end, like it does with states, with a genuine antipathy for other people. I mean, you joke about being from Texas, not from Oklahoma, you know, how, oh, the, you know, the IQ of both states went up, you know, and stuff like that, all those jokes. We tell those jokes, and it's just a laugh, and, oh, nobody means it seriously, and before you know it, state troopers are giving tickets to anybody who's got an Oklahoma license plate on Texas OU weekend. A reality I encountered from state troopers who were bragging about doing it at church the day after the Texas OU game one time. Now, so I'm just saying, I get the joke, I get the lightheartedness of it, and I get the ethos of it, and it's natural for us to have that. We should probably be conscientious about how we convey that, just as a side note. But also this idea that we train into ourselves a tendency to stay in the denomination that we grew up in, or at least that our faith grew up in, is also overt sometimes. We make an effort to indoctrinate, to train people, to hold on to the teachings that are received by our denominational forebearers. And there's a value in that. There is importance in this. By the way, another side note, very brief, but in higher education, and in Christian higher education, there is an attempt to reduce what we do to indoctrination. And I push back hard against that. That's not what we do in Christian higher education. That's not good enough for Christian higher education. It's critically important. It's valuable, and it's something churches ought to do, and that we ought to value as Christians within churches. But it's not what higher ed ought to be doing. So, separate note. So, back to, you know, in your denomination, in your church, you have this overt indoctrination. You have Sunday school opportunities to say, well, this is what we believe, and it's in contrast to what other groups believe. They would hold this view. These people are paedo-baptists, but we believe in believer's baptism, or vice versa when you go the other direction. I had a former Presbyterian elder who was a member of my church when I was pastoring a Baptist church in Arlington, who explained to me how he had learned to teach why paedobaptism, baptism of babies, was an important component of Presbyterian life, and why it was denominationally justified, and why it was justified in terms of biblical faith and covenantalism and so on. And that man joined my church, and he still believed that. And I would sit down with him regularly and say, yeah, but we don't teach that here. And he would say, oh, I know, I don't cross the line. I mean, I hold the view, but I'm not going to teach it. And he became a Sunday school teacher for us. He was a great Sunday school teacher, by the way. but he knew the lines to play within, to be a part of our church in our denomination, which was different from where he had come from. And the point is that it makes sense to teach within your group why your group holds the views that it holds. And that's why we have, in some denominations, formal catechism, literally memorizing answers so that we can make sure we understand the right things. All of those things are designed to make us people who would have a tendency, a default position of remaining in the denomination that we started out in. And by the way, there is always, and this one's probably more important than all of the others put together, there's always the social and relational inertia that comes with human existence. You don't want to have to make all new relationships all the time. You want to be able to continue in the friendships and even among relatives that you've always had these close relationships with. So that is one tiny sliver of the reality that the, you know, this is in quotation marks, the past is always present. I don't know who created that expression, but it's a powerful psychological reality that you always carry your past with you. That reality goes in every direction. I mean, sometimes people would refuse to be what their parents were denominationally because the past is present with them. But one sliver of it, of an expression, the past is always present, that you always have your past with you, is that it makes sense that you would be comfortable with the people you've been around most and longest and with which you've developed your relational skills and your sense of understanding of what it means to be part of a community and so on. All of those things put us in a default position where we would want to remain in the denomination we've been in to begin with. Then swing with me on the pendulum all the way to the other side of the room. There comes a moment when we might say, I don't even want to be associated with those people. It may be visceral. It may be emotional. It might be for 100 different reasons. But for some reason, suddenly, or maybe gradually over a great period of time, we decide we're going to bolt. We need to leave the denomination we've been a part of. And let me just make a point here. I will come back to the idea of churches in a little bit. But at this point, at least, and in the previous part of the conversation, I'm not talking about the church you grew up in, the congregation that you grew up in. I'm talking about the denomination. And in particular, about bolting here, it is about the denomination. There is a discussion worth having about when and whether a person ought to leave a church that they've been in for a long time or whatever. That's a different conversation. It crosses over here. In a Venn diagram, there may be 30% of ideas that cross over here, making up that statistic completely. But the point is, there's a crossover. But this is not about the church, the individual congregation, that is, but about the denomination that you've been a part of. And so there are a lot of reasons people would choose to go a different direction. I mean, it happens a lot during young adulthood, a lot, where a person becomes 18, 20, 22 years old, they're leaving high school or leaving college, whatever it is, there's a transformative opportunity, maybe in new relationships or whatever's going on, and they consider leaving. And that would, I mean, partially just because of the coming of age reality. So, I mean, it's only natural. I mean, I remember going with a youth pastor in my congregation. I was pastoring, and the youth director, we called him at the time, went with me to visit a young lady that we were hoping would be able to go to camp with us. Her friend had invited her, and her parents didn't want her to go because they were Catholic. And I understand the anxiety about that. And so we went over to the house, and we just said, hey, we'd love for her to be able to come with us to camp. And the dad said, well, you know, frankly, I'm just worried that y'all would be trying to persuade her to get saved or do something like that. And my youth director said, and this was really brilliant on his part. He was the best, one of the best youth directors I ever had. I mean, probably the best. I mean, he's just fantastic. Man was 6'8", so he wasn't intimidated by anybody. He's huge. Baseball, he had been recruited professionally for baseball. I said 6'8". I don't know, somewhere between 6'5" and 6-something. He was big, tall, just anyway, healthy guy. So this, you know, this dad said that, and my friend, he said, my youth pastor friend, he just said, well, I hope we do. I mean, that's why we go. And he just said it lightheartedly, but seriously, saying, well, of course we're going to try to persuade her that this is the way to go, but I promise there won't be any strong arming. We're just going to try to talk about why we do things the way we do. And at the end of the conversation, the dad said, you know, that makes sense. That's good. Yeah, she can go. It was fine because he trusted his daughter to make the whatever choice was going to be most important for her. The point is, she was in a youth group in her Catholic church. But she was coming of age, and she was trying to make her own way, and she wanted to think about her own things. And her dad patted her on the back and said, you know what, I'm going to trust you through this process. Good idea, bad idea, I don't know. I mean, you can decide as a family what you want to do with that. But that is part of the reality, that a child who's becoming an adult is going to have an occasion to think about everything. You know, do I really want to be a cobbler when I grow up, or do I want to be a doctor, or do I really want to be a professional when I grow up, or would I rather be blue collar? You know, they can think about all those things. Well, one of the things they're going to think about is denominationalism as well. And just the fact that as you become a young adult, you become independent too, and you may want to think of your identity independently of your parents. I've seen a lot of people go through that transition. I mean, again, I'm the president of a college right now, so I'm around a lot of 18 to 22-year-olds. And we watch these 18 to 22-year-olds show up under the shadow of their parents, but by the time they graduate, make their own way. And some of them are making their own way by trying to be distinct from what their parents were. It's just part of the reality of the human psyche. I don't know. So that's young adulthood. The other is certain experiences that people are having, sometimes during that same time period during their life, sometimes later, sometimes it might be earlier. I don't know. But I know with marriage and children, it happens all the time because somebody marries somebody of a different denomination, or somebody's kids love this church that they went to camp with, you know, and their parents suddenly visit that. And lo and behold, they're changing denominations. Really didn't change their opinion about anything other than the fact that they like being a part of this other congregation, which is a part of a different denomination. And so suddenly they are Presbyterian or Lutheran or Methodist or whatever, instead of Catholic or instead of Baptist and so on. I get the variety of differences that exist there and that some are greater than others. That's not the point today. It's just why people would change so far. And so there might be a decision to leave the former denomination because of that. And part of that is because, you know, you sit in on some church meeting or a camp setting, and you realize that this group, oh man, they're thinking about things. It's more intellectual than the more spiritual group I'd been a part of, or vice versa. You've been sitting and listening to lectures about perfect doctrine your entire life, and you go somewhere and somebody is filled with the Spirit and starts saying things you've never even thought about before. You're like, what on? And that, and there's something genuine or real about what's, I've got to be a part of this and try it out and see if this turns out to be real for me. It can be the fact that you've been used to congregations that wouldn't even plan who was going to get up on the platform to sing. And Aunt Bertha gets up there every week and sings a song, whether she can sing or not. And then you go to a church, and from beginning to end, every moment is choreographed and organized, and only the most beautiful voices and the most perfect readers participate in anything. And you're awestruck by the reverence given to the holiness of this moment, or vice versa, that you're so tired of being in a straitjacket that you love the sense that people just walk in and sort of enthusiastically follow the Spirit wherever it's going. And the same with the austere on one hand, you know, a very rigid sense that only the presence of God is what brings beauty to this context, as contrasted with beautiful stained glass and statues and draperies and everything being an expression of aesthetic value. And one or the other, you know, if you haven't had it, it seems fresh. The grass is always greener, right? So it would only be natural that psychologically we'd be drawn in one direction or another in those settings. Not to mention that God might actually get a hold of your heart through one of those things and say to you, you know, you've stagnated. I'm going to move you to a different field and see if you'll start doing something better than you were doing before. That happened to me when I was 16 years old. God put me in a different field in the independent Baptist world and shook me up. It was a lot of being hit about the head and neck with doctrine that was pretty harsh, but I needed it in the sense of just waking me up to the reality that God wanted to do something more with me than just be a backdrop for the rest of my life. And I'm grateful for that, very grateful for that input from that different setting, from that different field that God dropped me into. It can also come because, and this is what is motivating a lot of the conversations I've had lately, it can also come, this desire to bolt, you know, to move denominations from an anomaly, from, if we were putting it in more technical language, and it's not always this, but it could come from something of cognitive dissonance, right? So you've just had an experience that doesn't fit everything you thought your group was about, your organization was about, or the way you understood it to be has turned out not to be the way it actually is. Sometimes that happens when people are invited behind the curtain. Hey, help us organize the service, become a denominational leader, whatever. Then you see the decision-making and you realize it's not all fasting and prayer. And it's like, oh, I don't know if I want to be a part of this. And so you start looking for a greener, meaning more spiritual, more authentic, more genuine, or something that meets your needs better, whatever it is, setting than what you had found before. So anomalies can do that. You can have a sense of betrayal. A lot of us have had that in denominations at one point or another. And again, I'm not talking about churches. This does happen in churches where a particular leader betrays you or you find out something about them and they disappoint you and so on. I'm not talking about that. I mean a sense that denominationally, you're not supporting what I thought our churches were about, or you don't actually practice the things we thought we were supposed to be about as congregations. So there's a sense of betrayal, or there can be a sense of dissatisfaction. Wow, I've learned a lot of things that don't fit into that denomination. Intellectually, maybe relationally, I figured out that I remember the first time meeting someone in a denomination that our independent Baptist world had criticized freely all the time. And I was doing it along with everybody else. I'm not picking on anybody else. And realized they were really fine believers. And it was like, what? How could I have been thinking what I was thinking before? Because I developed a friendship with somebody who was in a different denomination, and I realized their faith was as sincere and real and in Christ as mine was, and probably more so, part of what I needed to learn from them. And it can be social or whatever, but those anomalies can send you running, right, from the denomination you're in right now. So what I want to figure out is between those two places, it's where some people find themselves, where they're in the denomination that their tendency is to remain, and yet they're being confronted by something that's saying to them, why are you still participating in this? And so I just want to consider the options that we have. There are reasons to leave, and I will keep these brief. There are reasons that you would say, you know, I just can't be a part of this. And in this case, I will say with these particular examples, they may apply as well to a church as to a denomination, I think, just in these examples. So reasons to leave. And in fact, I'll just give you one overall. And it's when it's toxic to you, when it's making you a less healthy person than you would be otherwise to remain a part of this, either church or denomination. And that can be, you know, I mean, it can be revealed 100 different ways, and these evidences may not actually be any indication that it's toxic to you. So it requires a lot more than this to know this, but these would be reasons for you to think about it. If all going to church does for you, if all being a part of this organization does for you, is create anger or stress in your life, something's wrong. Now, the thing that's wrong may just be you. And in fact, it likely is more you than the context. I would always say that because, you know, it's normally in us. I think there are indications of that in the New Testament and the way Paul talks about bitterness. But it is also possible that the context can contribute to that and that it may be a cause for you to reexamine your relationship in that setting. I think, you know, an evidence for me that you might need to rethink a denominational connection or a church connection would be what it does to your family or to your relationships. So when I was younger, it was common for us to talk about cults and recognize as one of their characteristics the need to sever you from any other relationships that you had. So you need to move with us to Utah. You know, you need to get out here in the woods with us. And you can't talk to your parents anymore. Give us your cell phones. You're not going to have any of those connections anymore. You know, we would say that's kind of a cult, isn't it? I mean, there's something wrong with that when that's going on. It's not that you have to maintain every relationship for the rest of your life because some of your relationships are toxic. I get that. So that's fine. That's up to you. But if it's a requirement of your organization that you behave in such a way that you have to hate your father and mother, now I'll come back to the biblical expression in a second, that you have to despise your siblings, that you find that you can no longer sit down at the Thanksgiving table and have a peaceable conversation with the people you grew up with because of the group you're a part of. Yeah, you probably need to think about that really hard, and it might be a reason for you to say, this is not making me healthier. This is not helping me demonstrate the love that Christ says I'm supposed to have for other people. And to address that phrase in particular, unless a man hates his father and mother, he cannot be my disciple. In its context, and we went through it verse by verse, we've done it on this podcast before, line by line to understand what that means. It goes hand in hand with the expression that unless you take up your cross, it doesn't mean you have to go find a cross and nail yourself to it. It means in the day you choose to follow Christ, you choose to accept the reality that some of the people you're going to serve are going to crucify you one day. It means that the day you choose to follow Christ, you choose to accept the fact that your parents may despise you from that day forward when they find out you're a follower of Christ. But that's about them rejecting you, not you rejecting them. You're choosing to follow Christ at a level that says, I accept the fact that this may alienate me from my family. But I'm not going to create the alienation. That's up to them. They have to choose to reject me as I follow Christ. If you find yourself despising or disdaining other people in your life because of your religious affiliations of any kind, and I'm a Christ follower to the end of the age, no qualms about that whatsoever, but if you find yourself despising other people because you're a Christ follower, and especially those of your own family, it's time to back up and take a look at the group you've made yourself a part of. So that's a reason to consider leaving. I'm not saying you do leave. I'm saying it's a reason to examine yourself, get some advice, get some outside conversations going, and make a good decision. And I would also say it's not hard to figure out that if you're a part of an organization, denominationally or locally, that undermines the practice of your faith, that's toxic to the health of the practice of your Christianity, then you need to rethink it. If your denomination or your church makes you less loving, makes you less trusting of God, makes you less harmless to other people, makes you less honest as an individual, then yeah, it's time to rethink it. There are settings that are like that, and that would merit a person saying, I'm going to need to be a part of a different group. That's fine. That's good. There are also I would put these in the category where I would say these are not reasons to leave. Those would be reasons that you might need to leave. These are not reasons to leave. One, that you just don't need it. That's not what our Christian connections are about, what we need. We do need them, and that is important, and it is worthwhile, but that's not principally what we're supposed to consider when we're coming into a relationship or a community. We're supposed to be thinking, how does God want to use me to serve this community? Because we have become Christ followers. We follow him into the role of service. In the same way, I would say it's not going to be enough to say, well, I just don't like some of those people, so I'm going to go somewhere else. The point of Christianity is to be able to love people you don't like. And also, I do think that ends up meaning you like people that you don't like. you end up there. But in the meantime, we're supposed to love people that we don't like. So I don't think those are reasons to leave. But there are also some positive reasons that we should not leave. And this is, for me, I've had to think about this a lot. There are things going on in every denomination, doesn't matter which denomination, in all of them, that I think make everybody reconsider, you know, things that are going on with sex abuse allegations across the spectrum, things that go on with racism. One denomination is this race, another denomination is another race. A lot of the permeation of social strata in our culture is due to denominational identities, or at least perpetuated by denominational entities, or if I were to be more generous than that, at least not addressed by denominational identities. And that's enough to make a person who's aware of those things, who's paying attention to them, be aggravated and say, I'm just not going to be a part of that anymore. I get all of that. And I've experienced a lot of that. And in that context, why would I say to someone, but I don't think you should leave it? You know, I think there is a reason for you not to leave despite the frustrations or the other reasons that you have for leaving it. And here's what I would give is a reason not to leave. This, if you think about it, in order for me to say this and make sense of it, I sort of need to explain the opposite of it. I think the reason a lot of us consider leaving a group or a denomination is sort of out of embarrassment. And I don't mean personal embarrassment, but I mean thinking, I think that's an embarrassment to Christianity. People shouldn't be like that if they're going to follow Christ. So I don't want anything to do with that. But the reality of being a Christian, the reality of Christianity, identification with people who embarrass God is just a part of Christian nature. It's a part of what it is to be in God's world. He's always embarrassed by his people. And I don't mean, I'm not describing his psychological state. I mean, his people are always doing things that bring shame on his name. That's throughout the history of the world, all the way into the history of the church. Post and pre-resurrection, this is the reality of God's people. And what I want to give you as a way of considering that is the language of Ezekiel. Ezekiel 36. I could pick it out from Abraham going down to Egypt and his behavior with the king there right after he's called, all the way through Genesis and Exodus, the people in Egypt, the people of Israel who are led out into the wilderness and even there choose to worship idols. And Moses is saying, I don't know what to do here. God says, I'm going to destroy these people. And Moses says, don't do it, although they are embarrassing you and so on. You know, it is God's people are constantly embarrassing God. And yet his response to that, which we could do from Hosea, for instance, that is the point of the book of Hosea, as shameful as it could be. God says, I'm not giving up on them. I want you to take the flowers to them and bring them home to me. And in Ezekiel, he makes this point. When God brings up the shame that his people are putting on his name in Ezekiel 36, where he says to Ezekiel, but I had concern for my holy name. He does this extensively. He talks about a lot of the reasons and what the Israelites have done to bring this to pass and so on. But he ends this way by saying, but I had concern for my holy name, which the house of Israel had profaned among the nations to which they came. What's his response to that? His response could have been to say, so I'm cutting and running. I'm not going to deal with that. I'm going to start over. I'm going to use different people. I'm not going to allow them to embarrass me, to shame my name, and then me stay a part of what they're doing. But instead of that, this is what he says. And this is starting in verse 23 of Ezekiel 36. I will vindicate the holiness of my great name. Now, he could do that a lot of ways. You know, destroy Israel, bring fire down on them, and so on. The judgment would have vindicated his holy name. But this is how he says it. I'll vindicate the holiness of my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, which you have profaned among them. And the nations will know that I am the Lord, declares the Lord God, when through you, and again, the through you is ambiguous here. Could be that he's about to say he's going to judge them. that when through you I vindicate my holiness before their eyes. But here's how he says he's going to do it. I will take you from the nations and gather you from all the countries and bring you into your own land. I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you'll be clean from all your uncleannesses, and from all your idols I will cleanse you. And I'll give you a new heart, and a new spirit I'll put within you. And I'll remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I know the new covenant. I know what he's talking about in the resurrection. The same thing is happening with the church at Corinth. The same thing happens in the conflict that's going on in Philippi. It's pre and post resurrection. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules. The point is, God himself doesn't give up on people just because they shame his name. He continues with them, and he works to bring them back to what they're supposed to be. And I think, you know, so look, the reality is there is no pristine place to go and be identified with the people of God. Every single group has embarrassments that go with it, and the jokes that go from the people who don't know God, who make justifiable jokes about the things that happened in the Catholic Church, the things that happen in Southern Baptist churches, the things that have happened in other denominations. They make the jokes and they say, oh, what an embarrassment, you people. And it can be intellectual jokes, what a bunch of idiots. It can be behavioral jokes, what a bunch of immoral hypocrites. Whatever the jokes are, we know they have some legs. The jokes are funny because they're true. And then we think to ourselves, well, I'm not going to be identified with that. Well, like it or not, we're identified with it. If we follow Christ, this is, so but the point is, denominationally, you can't run. There's no pristine place to go. And that's not accidentally. It's not just because I've done a study and each denomination has its flaws. It's necessarily true because of a bunch of different things. But I'll just give you one dichotomy that makes it necessarily true. If you chose an elitist denomination that was pristine to the T, every doctrine exactly what it's supposed to be, and every practice exactly what it's supposed to be, every elitist denomination like that would be Pharisaical. Because what Pharisees do in Scripture, the ones that are condemned by Jesus, they use the commands God gave so that we would love our neighbors, so that we ourselves can exclude those very neighbors from our pristine selves. Whether it's doctrinal purity or behavioral tests or cultural norms that are being passed down from one group to the next, if you become a part of a group where everybody's got to measure up, then you've become part of a Pharisaical group, and that's not what we're called to. If you, on the other hand, say, oh, I'm going to be part of an inclusive group, we're going to invite those people in, and we're going to love the outsiders, well, then you're going to have an impure group, you know, because the reality is that no one enters with doctrinal or practical maturity in their faith, and no amount of maturity divides between wheat and tare without culling some wheat or trusting some of the tares. Jesus doesn't even entrust it to us. He says you don't have the ability to pick out between the wheat and the tares, which means we're going to be living among tares if we're in a congregation or a denomination that's more inclusive. So you don't have the option of saying, I'm going to go where everything's right. There is no pristine, broader Christian identity. It just doesn't exist. It's never going to exist, not until Christ returns. But it's also not an option to go nowhere. Not for a follower of Christ. There is no existing in Christ without existing in his body in this world. And I wish we had time to expand on that idea. We don't grasp the idea very well because we're not very communitarian in our thinking. And I've had long conversations on this podcast in other episodes about why it's important for us to recognize our communitarian nature and still value the individualism that we have. I'd love to talk about all that again. Encourage you to go back and find those episodes. Daisy can link to them on the website so that you can find them. But it is a reality of Christianity that you can't be a part of Christ without being a part of his body. And his body in the world is believers. We're a part of each other. We're inherently tied to each other. even if I were just to put it socially, if you say to somebody, well, I'm a Christian, but I'm not associated with all those other Christians, they're not going to believe you. Either you believe the things of Christ or you don't. You're not like the one true believer in the entirety of the world. It doesn't make any sense. And I think Ruth's words are the perfect model for reality. I don't have a last name for her. You know, Ruth in the Bible, that Ruth. Ruth's words, they're the model of reality. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. We are tied to each other at the hip because our Creator tied us together at the hip. So the point here is that there is no bearing the name of Christ without bearing the reputation of all the other people that bear the name of Christ. And that's just the way it is. So we can either run and hide from that reputation to no avail. There's no getting away from it. You want to be attached to God, you're going to be attached to his people. Or we stay and bear the burden of that reputation. And I think we have to choose this one, to stay and bear the burden of that reputation. Until he abandons the people who claim his name, it's hard to argue that we should abandon them. And believe me, that statement is much to my chagrin. But then again, the last thing in the world I deserve to do is measure any chagrin I experience against God's with me.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.